so much of it has to do with this idea of deeply caring about something. You know, you can be a coffee nerd, or you can be a watch nerd, or you can be a fashion nerd, you know, and being a snob for me always has to do with, you know, just really deeply caring, or caring significantly more about something than others.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Partners in Time. My name is Chris Granger. I'm the CEO of IWC Schaffhausen and your host on this podcast. During my time at IWC, I've been lucky to meet so many different people who connect with the brand. From clients and collectors, to engineers, to content creators, actors, racing drivers, pilots, and so on. And I've noticed many of these people share something. They share that unique focus and a unique passion for what they do. Now, on this podcast, every week, we're going to meet one of those partners in time. We're going to discuss what drives them, their passion, how they connect to time, and hopefully they'll be sharing some of their successes and secrets to success with our listeners. Now, time is precious, so let's jump right in and get started. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of Partners in Time. This has been quite a unique period of 2 weeks or so. We've just completed our Watches and Wonders period of presenting mostly digitally, but also a bit physically in Shanghai with the physical Watches and Wonders Fair. And of course, due to the current travel restrictions, we did it all here via hologram live streaming from Switzerland. And of course, we are now used to really take to digital media, to live streaming, to podcasting, to Clubhouse, and to all the new media to really bring our novelties and our new products across. And I think that's changed really quite a bit the way that taste making it happens compared to how it used to be. I mean, we've been much, much more isolated the last year, and I think that's really accelerated the way that digital media in all their shape and form have become such a central element in tastemaking. And I'm really excited today to be joined by somebody who's really at the heart of all of this, because David Fisher from High Snobiety is really somebody who started in the blogosphere and developed over time into one of the main tastemaking platforms for popular culture, sneaker, art, cars, fashion, everything that goes with it. And he's really somebody who's built today almost in a 360-degree international empire from what used to be a humble blog back in 2005. David, it's fantastic to have you with us. How are you?
Hi, Chris. Really great to be here. I'm really well, and I, of course, appreciate the kind introduction.
Yeah, no, of course, it's true. I mean, if I understand correctly, you started back in 2005, I think, with a blog, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's really crazy to think about it today, because it's kind of a long time ago, I suppose I'm lucky that it didn't feel that long. I was studying in Zurich at the time and had a bit of extra time on my hands and started reading blogs that came mostly from the US at the time. And I was inspired by the medium, actually, more so than, let's say, having a desperate need to share my thoughts. But I was actually very, very excited by the medium, the technology behind blogs. And so set one up at the time and started blogging. And obviously, I wrote about the things that I care deeply about, and sneakers, sneaker culture at large, Japanese fashion and streetwear were, you know, a few of my passions. And that's how the journey began. Mm.
No, and it's been an amazing journey indeed. So maybe for our listeners, tell us a little bit, what's High Snobiety all about, and what's the journey been like?
So yeah, I mean, as I mentioned, I started in 2005, and you know, it really quickly became a small publishing business that was monetizing through digital advertising. So quite classic in a sense back then, and you know, we were taking care mostly of the content creation aspect, and then we worked with different agencies to monetize the blog through advertising, and then. You know, it was an interesting time, you know, if you think about it now, because looking back, I started a few months before YouTube was founded, you know, which is kind of weird to think about now.
Probably 10 years before the iPhone was launched or something like that, or at least the iPad.
Not that long, but I'm not that old, okay?
But well, iPhone was one, from 2006, yeah. 2007?
Yeah, exactly.
I see. And then iPad, I think, what, 2013 or 2011? I
mean, somewhere around there.
It's crazy.
So it was... Yeah, so it was pre-iPhone, pre-YouTube, pre-Instagram, pre-Facebook, pre-Twitter. You know, so
so you blogged on really, facts, basically, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, real news. And so it was just a completely different environment. Getting people to your site, you know, promoting, marketing your brand was a completely different ballgame at the time. And at the same time, there was of course plenty of opportunity because, you know, I entered all of these platforms with HeistNobody like on day three. You know, so we had a Facebook page and then really early on an Instagram page, and so we, you know, we were able to build very authentic communities around our brand at a time where there was no paid advertising on any of these platforms. And, you know, so that was the one thing that happened. And then the other thing that of course happened was we got quite lucky, you know, with the topics that we picked or I guess that I was passionate about, because believe it or not, nobody cared about sneakers in 2005 and nobody cared about men's fashion in 2005. And nobody cared about streetwear in 2005. And in all three cases, you know, which were really the building blocks or content pillars of HeistNobody from the very early days, all three really exploded in the following years. You know, sneakers went from, you know, being a niche footwear item or an item that was used for the most part only for sports to really anybody, you know, from kids to grandparents was suddenly wearing sneakers. And, you know, 5 years later, streetwear, you know, went both luxury and to the main street, to the high street in a few years' time. And menswear really took over the world as well. Men caring about fashion, brands caring about having a menswear line, and of course, also the significance of the menswear line within the portfolio of brands significantly grew over the years. And I think the combination of, you know, the topics that we care deeply about and, you know, this, you know, massive growth in social media really gave us, of course, also a significant boost. And I think that's more or less what happened in the first 5, 6, 7 years of HeistNobody. And then on the business side, we eventually made a move into branded content in the early 2010s. You know, we built a creative team, production team. You know, so the relationship with brands, you know, got a whole lot deeper and was a bit less transactional. And we've really been on that path now for almost 10 years. You know, so we built that out into, you know, helping brands with talent, helping brands with experiential, helping brands, you know, to really understand this audience inside out. Mm-hmm. And then I think the last step on that business journey for us was really the addition of insights and data on one hand, and then also strategy, which allowed us to connect the insights and the data with the creative that we were building for brands. And that really changed completely the relationship we started having with brands. It became a whole lot more consultative and it became a whole lot more strategic. And as a result, the working relationship with brands became a lot more long-term, which is of course really exciting for us because we suddenly started working a lot more in depth, and you know, and we could really start advising on talent, on product curation, on of course content, you know, which always kind of stands at the heart of everything that we do. And and that's really been a really exciting journey for me personally also, because everything, you know, HeistNobody exists because of my love for great product. And, you know, being able to influence what that product may look like today, what the collaboration, who the collaborator may be, and how that product is then marketed in a relevant way, is of course, I mean, a very, very satisfying, you know, journey. And so, yeah, so that's, you know, how that has really changed over the years. And then last but not least, you know, we're also on an exciting journey as a brand ourselves. You know, because we don't really regard ourselves purely as a publisher or an agency, but above all, really as our own brand. And so we've made a move into e-commerce a couple of years ago, and we've really started building our own product, building and making and designing our own product. And that's of course been really exciting too, because again, I mean, if you love product, then the ultimate, you know, expression is of course, you know, being in the driver's seat and making your own. Yeah.
Not just writing about it, but actually making it.
Exactly. I mean, you notice, I mean, there's nothing like holding a new watch in your hand that you've been working on for months and years. It's the same excitement for us, you know, when we make a t-shirt, a cap, a pair of sneakers with a collaboration partner or anything else. And more than anything, I'm thankful that we're allowed to do that.
So the question really is, when are you opening your first hotel?
Yeah, it's funny that you ask. We have no plans for hotels yet.
We have to change that. I want to do a hotel here at IWC. I've always been dreaming about this sort of extreme sort of treetop lodge type thing just opposite our manufacturing center. And I think we should do that.
That would be awesome.
Yeah, brilliant. We could.
No, and you know, we speak so much these days about, you know, brands being universes more than anything. And you know, as crazy as it may sound today, I mean, a hotel is such a great, you know, complimentary piece of the experience there. And
If you can control the service experience, yes.
Yeah.
If you outsource that to XYZ, sometimes not.
That's true. That, I mean, that's the tricky part, I guess, right? I mean, what then ultimately really makes sense and what less so? But I think it's exciting that, you know, as a brand, but also, you know, for ourselves, as a publisher and agency partner, that you don't have to think in these buckets anymore, you know, that you can allow yourself to be elastic and move into different territories and do all kinds of exciting things these days.
So I've got to ask you before we get onto your first watch experience, but also, and I'm going to tell you mine afterwards, but I want to know, what is your first sneaker experience that you can actually remember where you think it changed from sort of, I don't know, mom or dad buying you a pair of shoes to you actively making a style choice when it comes to your footwear?
It's a good question. And I'm not sure I have this incredible story I can tell you there, but I certainly do remember quite firmly when, you know, when kids around me in school started, you know, what I loved about it, and that's what I love about our market in general, I love the specificity around it, you know, and I had a few kids around me that, you know, were kind of known to care about fashion and style a bit more so than, let's say, the average kid. And they suddenly all started wearing a rolled up pair of Levi's jeans mm-hmm. and a Air Force One high top sneaker. And, you know, and I will never forget that moment because I mean, that was for me the first time where I really came home and I was like, "Hey, mom, we have to go to Foot Locker and I need to pick up a pair of this exact type of sneaker because I want to wear it in this specific way."
Where did you have a Foot Locker back in those days? I mean, I had one in Frankfurt, but I had to travel to that basically.
Same thing. Exactly. So at that time I was living outside of Frankfurt actually.
Oh, so we went to the same Foot Locker, Hauptwache, huh?
Exactly.
That yeah,
that's exactly the Foot Locker I went to and where I picked up my first pair of Air Force Ones. And I will never forget them. It was a navy blue pair, mid-top Air Force One.
Yeah.
And the ankle strap had an American flag on it. And it was...
There you go.
Yeah, it was a very special sneaker for me. And I remember, funnily, a few moments like that. Funnily, all in that Foot Locker,
yeah.
You know, like the Air Max 97, yeah. That silver Nike shoe was a huge deal because that was the first time where I really, really remember spending, I mean, for that age, especially a considerable amount of money on a sneaker. That was a lot of money.
Definitely.
And so, yeah. So I think that's my first sneaker experience.
That's amazing. That's so cool because, you know, in the end, my mom actually refused to go into that Foot Locker. So I would go in there because she found it way too stressful. You know, this is the time before social distancing and this store was, even back then, was very much packed. And she would send me in there. She would let me do my thing. And then ultimately, if I could twist her arm to buy me a pair, she would come in and pay for them. But she would not go into the store.
I was fascinated by the store, by the product. But to be honest, also because of the skateboarders in front of it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, it was such a cool place, you know, because you had all these skaters there, you know, all these cool looking kids. And so I would, you know, was almost hypnotized, you know, when I would go there.
My goodness, and especially, you know, memories.
Yeah, totally. And especially being a kid that didn't live in town. You know, I was like living half an hour outside of town, you know, so it was an even bigger deal, I suppose.
Definitely. Yeah. And then Tile Gallery opened, which was the first like weird circulation mall where you had to take escalators all the way to the top and then wind your way back down past hundreds of stores you didn't want to go to just to get to the one shop you're actually looking for. Oh yeah.
Actually, Tile Gallery, I can tell you also, This is amazing that you know all of this, but or that you experienced the same thing. Because in Teil Galerie, there were two shops that mattered for me. One, which was selling the starter jackets.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, and
the team caps from the American ice hockey and NFL teams. And then there was the other one, which was this kind of weird stoner shop. So they had all these like marijuana posters and
I didn't go to that one.
Patches. So I went there. No, I mean, this was like mid late 90s.
Yeah.
And so, so obviously there was no legal marijuana or anything, but it was like, it was, you know, just artwork inspired by that world.
Yeah.
You know, and I bought patches for my Eastpak backpack there.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. So, yes, definitely. Yeah. Starter and Eastpak, those were the brands. Yeah. And see, that for me, I think it was probably a touch earlier than that. I must have been around 11, just starting secondary school. And this was the moment when LA Gear became a thing. I don't know if you remember LA Gear.
I do remember, but funnily, that was never a thing for me.
And this
I'm not sure if I was too old or too young.
This was huge in my school. And this was literally, I think I would have worn like the type of sort of orthopedic Puma trainers before, sort of ankle boots for stability, that kind of thing. And then LA Gear came along and changed everything, because suddenly you had this like sort of amazing world of LA lifestyle that came with this kind of product. And they had this unique sort of a folded over leather strip lamella type pattern on the side of them that revealed the reverse leather color, well, plastic color on the side of the trainer, pretty much like Gucci did under Tom Ford in fine tailoring many, many years later. But that was the signature for LA Gear. And I think I discussed with my mom and dad for at least 4 months until they would buy me this black and white pair of high top LA Gear basketball sneakers.
Amazing.
And then I had this thing. I remember we bought them. I got them home in the box. I was really, really scared something was going to happen to them. And that night, I actually woke up completely sweaty from having this nightmare that I was sliding on mud in these trainers that completely destroyed them. And this was like my biggest fear of my 11-year-old self. So that was my first sneaker story.
Amazing. I actually met the founder of LA Gear not long ago, 2-3 years ago. Yeah. And he ended up founding Skechers.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So and there's a, I mean, I don't think we have time for it today, but there's a really good story around LA Gear also. Okay. You know, how that happened and how it became a thing and how it stopped being a thing. So
yeah, that's maybe the thing also back then, because of the absence of the internet and social media, you couldn't find out this stuff, you know, unless you knew or had the catalog or whatever, which we never did.
Yeah.
You know, you just didn't know all these amazing stories. And when you think about the wealth of information that's actually available today around this whole concept of streetwear and the culture and the influences and all the rest of it, none of this was really accessible. For me, this was just what somebody else wore. And it was sort of the merchandise that I could see in the sports shop, which was sneakers, laces, and maybe a t-shirt. And that was pretty much it.
Yeah, totally. Well, and that's why, you know, today you've got, you know, 16-year-old kids that, you know, can tell you everything about, you know, Raph Simons garment from 2002. You know, like, and you're just amazed how they can be so much in the know. But, you know, this idea of, you know, being, and finally, I really also do connect that. I just had a great conversation here internally with our graphic design team, and because, you know, we're designing the next fall winter collection, and I tried to explain to them, you know, how I would describe the Heist Nobody brand. And, you know, so much of it has to do with this idea of deeply caring about something, you know, and you can be, you know, you can be a coffee nerd, or you can be a watch nerd, or you can be a fashion nerd, you know, and being a snob for me, you know, that's, you know, because it, you know, can also have a bit of a negative connotation, but being a snob for me always has to do with, you know, just really deeply caring, or caring significantly more about something than others. You know, and also in the watch space, I would always say, you know, I love as much, you know, the G-Shock and the Swatch as I do the IWC, you know, like each for their own right.
Yeah.
And I think having that understanding about a space, like that's what makes you, that's, you know, what makes you a nerd or a high snob, so to speak, you know, like that's how I would always describe it. And, you know, when I try to explain to our editors, you know, how to address this audience, what to expect from them, you know, what do you have to explain to a high snobbiter reader and what should you never explain? Mm. You know, what should you expect, you know, of them to know already?
Yeah.
And I think that's fascinating nowadays, of course.
It is, yeah. And I think that's also where the world of watchmaking and that specific genre and especially sneakers and streetwear really intersect is this idea of the depth of immersion that you can have in these worlds. And I think that's something that really our clients are looking for probably in your world as much in our world. Because when it comes to sneakers, it's basically the same principle. You know, yeah, you can't buy everything in store, but you can go into a store, you can go online, and you can select something purely on the style you like and, you know, without any background story on collabs and history and who all these people wear, et cetera, et cetera. But you can purely do this on, I like this shoe, I'll wear it. And I think that's the same for watches. You know, you have clients who simply like the brand, they like the design, and that's what they're going to go for. But then if you get deeper into it, or as you describe it, you become a sort of snob, somebody who cares about their stylistic choices a lot and makes them very consciously, then you can immerse yourself almost indefinitely into the subject matter. You know, there's so much history, so much creation, technical depth to be explored.
Absolutely.
I really think that is something that appeals to people in that space quite a lot nowadays, because you have this range.
Absolutely. And it's you know, it's very much also the foundation of, you know, how we coined the term new luxury. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, we speak so much about, you know how in old luxury, obviously craftsmanship and price and heritage are kind of the main pillars. And all these things still matter very much, but knowledge and access are, you know, really key drivers for what makes something luxurious to a young audience nowadays. And, you know, being immersed in the brand's story and, knowing everything about, you know, a product of that brand really adds significant value. Yeah. And the watch space, of course, lends itself incredibly to that.
Yeah.
Because there's just so much knowledge, you know, that comes with it. So I totally agree.
It's amazing sometimes. Literally yesterday, I had the first conversation ever with a very young client of ours from New York City. And in the first 15 minutes of conversation, I realized this gentleman knew absolutely everything about the brand. It was absolute. He started to talk to me about, you know, the collaboration history between us and Mark Ong of Sabotage in Singapore and stuff like that. I was like, oh my goodness, mate. You know, I could probably ask 50% of my colleagues internally.
They've never even heard of it.
Yeah, I don't want to insult anybody. But, you know, it's like the level of, I mean, he knew, like, you know, all my quotes from interviews from years ago, and I was like, my goodness me.
Wow.
You know, and there are people, they have an incredible level of research. And even, and that is also the thing, you know, we traditionally in our industry maybe associated that with the world of longstanding collectors. But yeah, nowadays you meet 20-year-olds who maybe have never bought a product from you, but they know absolutely everything. And this is also, you know, in no small part, thanks to people like you who are creating these platforms that, yes, are making tastes and creating trends, but they're also hugely educational, but in a very sort of democratic way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, you know, I think that's the fine line that I tried to describe before. How can you be educational while still taking your counterpart, your community on the other side very serious?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's kind of that fine line that we always try to strike. And a few days ago, I was in Hamburg with a colleague of mine, and you know, he's in his late 30s. We're talking about watches. And then it was funny, he said, and it was such a true thing, I thought. He said, yeah, you know, David, it's a bit like you're graduating from sneakers and you're moving into watches. You know, it's almost like a generational thing that, you know, you were maybe a sneaker collector or a streetwear fan. So you understand the mechanics. You know, you have that level of interest in certain things. Mm. But then you reach a certain age where maybe, you know, the value and knowledge and access around watches becomes more appealing to you than sneakers do, in a sense. And so I really think it's, you know, it's something that, you know, that is very interconnected, just because the idea of caring this much about something is the same. Yeah. In a sense.
Yeah. No, absolutely. And I think what I think is so valuable is that you have really the translator element of platforms like yours that also make that a little bit less daunting? Because I do realize that an industry like ours that has a lot of sort of technical expertise and heritage and all of this, it can be a bit scary, you know. And then sometimes you feel, if you go to, you know, traditional retail, you're almost expected to have sort of the, you know, it's just like me going to a whiskey or a wine store and then being sort of, you know, gloriously exposed for my knowledge of vintages and all the rest of it. And it can be a bit scary at times. And I think what you do is you're translating that into a world that people can relate to and into sort of something a little bit more accessible that people can then start venture into something in a light version before they feel they need to have a PhD in mechanical engineering.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's exactly it. You know, and I think 10 years ago, that's how luxury fashion felt like. Mm. You know, you know, you just felt out of place in a sense. Mm. And I think they've come a really long way there. And I think, I mean, watches and knowing about watch, I think is extremely present in our space at this stage. But I think watch retail is, you know, is still very much stuck in the old days, much like you described. You know, it's a big barrier, I think, that a young person has to overcome to walk into, you know, a more traditional watch retailer. Sit down, ask for a watch to be taken out of the glass box. You know,
I think the story that Aurel Bax shared in the last episode of Partners in Time with us, when he got his first IWC at Chronometrie Bayer in Zurich from his parents, they were just about to go to the store and his dad probably stopped him in his tracks and said, you know, Aurel, what are you wearing? You know, put on a decent shirt. We're going to Bayer, for heaven's sake.
That's amazing.
You know? And that sort of describes the cultural shift a little bit over the last couple of years. And I have to honestly say, back in 2005, I probably wouldn't have been able to name a lot of different generations of Air Jordans. So for you as well, it must have been there must have been a moment where you thought, you know, what's going on here? This is what I used to blog about. You know, I didn't know anything about Japanese denim back in the day, and suddenly this has become sort of mainstream enough to really get critical mass. You know, it's not no longer really a niche pursuit. Where was this moment when you really sort of felt, oh, well, I'm onto something here? This is becoming quite big.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, so. First, maybe I'll tell you one story, which kind of showed you how far away I was from everybody around me at that time. So I remember in 2000, I would say seven, eight, a close friend of mine in Zurich got married. And I was at the like pre-wedding dinner. And you have to imagine there were about 20 people at that pre-wedding dinner. And 18 of them worked in banks. And then there was my wife and I. and then obviously the big question was like, okay, what does that guy do? And I had the difficult task of explaining to these people what I was doing. And so I sort of tried to explain them what High Snobiety was about through the example of Nike, you know, because Nike was, of course, like the epitome of, you know, sneaker culture, you know.
Yeah.
You know? And so... And I'm talking about Nike and limited edition sneakers and, you know, how people stand in line to get these sneakers and, you know, how it's this global phenomenon. And then eventually somebody in the room goes like, I mean, I kind of get it, but like, why are you talking about Nike the entire time? Puma is the coolest sneaker brand on the planet. You know, like, and it was just such a telling story at the time how far, you know, removed the general public was from, and people, I mean, those were all people my age, right?
Yeah.
How far removed they were from MySpace. And that has of course dramatically changed. I think what's funny there is that it's such a gradual change every single year that you sometimes, of course, don't even realize how much has actually changed until you suddenly turn around and you've got, you know, kids around you on Kudam wearing off-white shirts and Yeezys, you know, and that's when you realize, okay,
something's happening.
Yeah, something's happening. Or, you know, when you know, friends of my parents, you know, or you know, come around, they're like, yeah, my son bugged me again to buy him blah blah blah.
As long as kids don't come around and say, my dad's been bugging me about the latest.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. Or,
By the way, I have my own take on the Zurich dinner party, because I made this somewhat tragic mistake in the early years of IWC at these kind of dinner parties, that when I was surrounded by bankers, I did actually let on that I worked for IWC, which at this point you're then talking about nothing else for the entire evening. And my wife, in particular, my girlfriend at the time, got extremely sick of that very, very quickly. And she went like, you're so silly. Just tell them you work in a bank and you've got peace and quiet for the rest of the evening.
That's
and
amazing.
I actually switched this around, because once you say I'm a banker, all they ask you is it Credit Suisse or UBS? And after that, the conversation is over. And literally,
switches
you can
talk back to something else.
Yeah, they just move on. So perfect. That was amazing. My recipe. So maybe those 19 bankers at that pre-wedding dinner, they probably worked somewhere else. They just didn't want to admit it.
that would have been really funny, actually. Yeah.
But let's talk about your first watch moment, David. I mean, I remember there was something going on about the Da Vinci, but tell us more.
Yeah. So, It's really funny, actually. So, I mean, so suddenly a good friend of my dad was working for IWC. And so with that, my dad, of course, got a lot more into the brand as well. And so one day my dad basically ended up ordering himself his first, like, you know, like he had a sports watch, and now he wanted like something a bit more formal, so to speak. And ended up buying the IWC Da Vinci. And, you know, also there, I really remember when he received it and it came in this like white leather box and it had this like extra piece for the years, for the date. Because I think it
was Century Slider.
Exactly. Great, because I didn't know that word. But
see, need a PhD that was for that.
But that was, of course, that certainly fascinated me, you know, that this amazing piece of mechanical watchmaking, you know, was created and was supposed to run accurately for the next, I don't know, 300 years or so.
499,
And then finally, I almost forgot about that, but I received as an engagement gift from my parents-in-law, I received a Portuguese.
Oh, wow.
So, there we go. There's another IWC moment. So I received the beautiful 7-day reserve in rose gold.
For your engagement, lucky.
For my
lucky
engagement,
man.
Yeah, I got that. To be honest, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Got a box of Maltesers.
How freaking lucky am I? that's exactly what I was thinking at the time. But there was an engagement dinner, and then my mother-in-law handed me over the box, and I was like, "All right, I thought I was lucky because I'm getting to marry this woman, but like this is even better, you know."
I was gonna say that was very decent.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. Well, that's definitely something we noticed over the last couple of years, is that I think when I look at my own taste journey as well, and I came from a very similar, you know, I had swatches. I even had a Swatch I&E sort of mechanical, which I thought was excellent. In those days, my first watch memory clearly was spending what felt like a day at Tigerli and If Jewelers at Bern in Switzerland, while my dad bought his stainless steel Nautilus. And this was also
cool.
Long, long, long before that became a thing, really. And that was really for people in the know, you know, way before that really became a major sports watch trend. And then from there, I think it was definitely G-Shock. It was Citizen ProMaster. I loved the kind of Thule diving
Me too.
Look of the
Me
ProMaster.
Me too. I was always obsessed with Citizen dive watches. I will never forget the black bracelet, that kind of eggshell dial.
Yeah. Yeah.
The, you know, the orange. I'm missing the words. Tiger.
The hands. Yeah.
The orange hand. Yeah. I always loved those. Yeah. To this day.
No, definitely. Yeah. They had some weird dive depth calculation thingy on the strap, which I could never work out, but it looked immensely technical and cool. And from there, when I came across IWC, I really first clicked with the 2004 generation of the Aquatimer. That really was for me, because it's kind of this very sort of action-oriented adventure watch.
I remember those too.
Yeah.
Wasn't it like a black yellow?
Yeah, yeah. So they existed in titanium, black and yellow. And then in the stainless steel versions, they were either blue dial with orange or black dial with white quarter circle on the turning bezel. But this was definitely a watch that appealed to me. And then when I started sort of out in business here and everything was very formal and stuff, I switched over to Portugueses and Portofinos as well. And then really over time, the last 10 years, you could really see my taste slowly going to Pilot's watches. And I feel that really the entire sort of dress sense, cars, you know, watches, everything sort of changed almost like synchronized. And I don't know if you felt the same, but I really think this all goes hand in hand. When I then see that, you know, especially now in Chinese tastes, even you see the younger generation, tier one cities, Shanghai, Beijing, and Chengdu, and so on, they're really migrating towards the pilot's model and kind of these sportier expressions, which is completely different from the generation before.
And is it a mix of sporty, but also a bit that kind of vintage aspect to it, or not? I mean,
yeah, there is, you know, definitely. I think we have two expressions within sports. You have the small, as you described, you have the smaller diameter, very pure dial sports vintage that has a major trend over the last 3-4 years in particular, I would say. And then there's the kind of the sort of quite modern tool watch thing, which is going on as well, which we see reflected in the Aquatimer quite a bit. So yeah, that is definitely also something that people are increasingly migrating towards. But I think that the entire style is just casualizing massively.
Totally. I mean, what I'm fascinated with these days on the watch side is on one hand, I like it very, very simple. Mm. You know, you almost like don't want anybody to take notice. And then what I have to say, I'm also fascinated with this really technology and real innovation.
Yeah.
Because I feel like for such a long time that hasn't played a role. And I'm just so excited by, you know, what's happening in the watch world now on that front. Yeah. And how that finally matters and seems to kind of break through a little bit. You know, you always had a little bit with the Richard Mills of the world and a few other places here and there, but you never really saw it broadly worn in the sense.
Yeah, that's true.
But that's why, you know, I think what you guys just announced, that Big Pilot
was a
shock absorber. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, that was for me like the absolute highlight in that, you know, in the announcement. I was like, okay, this is super cool, you know.
This is exactly as you described, because on the one hand, and you see that in the Big Pilot 43 that has that clean dial with no date, no power reserve, because especially I love this discussion, because if you ask 100 people in the world whether they prefer watches with a pure dial or watches with a date, you get 50-50 or thereabouts. It's probably like a Brexit type of thing, you know, 51-49%, that sort of split of people saying you absolutely cannot buy a watch without a date and you can absolutely not buy a watch that has a date. So it's a bit like that. But you'll see now we have these kind of very, very essential tool watches in the lineup that are super pure, and then on the other hand you have a shock absorber where, yes, it's a different level of innovation, but it's also it's design wise it's much more forward looking. It's not a vintage inspired design at all. It's thoroughly modern and technical.
Yeah, I love that progressive look now.
Yeah, you have both of those trends in the market very strongly at the moment, definitely.
Yeah, which is so cool. I think it was also necessary. You know, I mean, how long could you just ride this kind of vintage wave? And I think it's great that brands and you guys included are kind of making a shift there as well, and also offering something in that space. And, you know, of course, also myself, you know, I'm always the kind of guy that, you know, I cannot just wear what everybody else is wearing, right? That would be boring. And so I think that's also where you're, of course, you know, really feeding into that side of my personality in the sense, you know, where I'm like, okay, great, that, you know, I'm not going to be standing in the room with four other guys, you know, wearing that watch, you know. So it's always, you know, a bit of weirdness, a bit of, you know, kind of needs to be there as well.
And that's the thing a little bit, you know, what I always wonder with the vintage thing, and it's a bit of a philosophical kind of observation, but when you project yourself sort of 50 years forward and you look at that time period that really started with a lot of, to my mind, it really started with these sort of automotive retro designs of the, what was it, late 1990s, I suppose, when sort of the Fiat Cinquecento came back and all these American Ford Thunderbird and Chrysler PT Cruiser and all of this stuff.
The Mini,
and all of this stuff, which really sort of went back in terms of the design language to the 50s and beyond. And then also in the sneaker world, you look at all of the retro editions that are being launched at the moment. And 50 years down the line, let's assume we move on from that at some point, it's going to be difficult to assess, you know, what is this? A bit like in architecture when you have sort of, you know, neoclassic, neo-Roman, neo-Regency style, forward, backward, and you can't identify what it is.
For such a long time, you know, I'm a huge architecture fan, and I'm like, how is it possible that architecture has become so boring, right? When you look back, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, you know, all the exciting things that have happened around the world, and now, you know, everything just looks the same. And you're just kind of wishing that things will change a bit again in that respect. So,
well, I have a theory about that, and that's, you know, maybe that's also a little bit linked to what we're seeing in the streetwear and the watch space. And my theory is always that I think at the height of modernism, there was a really, really clear shared vision of the future. You know, in the late 1950s, early 1960s, once really that generation was over the kind of post-war lull, that there was really this idea that an increase in productivity would create, you know, added value. It would create more jobs. It would create higher paid jobs. It would create free time. You know, you had the jumbo jet was invented. People started mass traveling all over the shop because they didn't have to work 7 days a week and so on. And suddenly this idea of making everything faster, more mobile, go to space, all the rest of it, it seemed like progress was all around positive. Everyone's going to get wealthier and life's just going to get better every single day. And I think that drove very, very clear design trends in architecture and automotive design that was inspired by space, in fashion, in all the rest of it. This outbreak in the 60s of joy of life and all the rest of it. And I think that really we have entered a phase post-modernism, as it were, where, you know, a lot of the, and I'm going to touch then on our final topic for this podcast, which is this whole question of sustainability. We came to a moment where both this promise of modernism that increased productivity and automation would bring more wealth to more people really collapsed. And that was really in the late 1980s, early 90s, that disparity between, you know, some people winning big and a lot of people not winning so much anymore, and that promise of modernism really fell apart. And then with this question of what machine evolution and AI and robotics are going to mean in terms of our position and our place in the world and our employment and our livelihoods, and at the same time the sustainability question of the planet's resources and future hanging overheads, I think we stopped having this single-minded, clear vision of a better future. And I think that has a lot to do with why we see so many different trends, why we see so much retro, and why there isn't such a clear development in architectural style or in fashion and in all the rest of it in terms of you know, moving forward. And I hope that we're going to get past this point and actually find a vision that people can share again. But let's talk a little bit about this question of hype and sustainability. I mean, I think you touched on it quite a number of times. The fact that ultimately, of course, spreading knowledge and spreading fascination for a topic such as sneakers and watches also ultimately leads to more consumption. It leads to more products being produced. It leads to more products being shipped around the planet, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, with everything that we link to sort of fast fashion and sneakers, et cetera, that there are some questions there, really, how you know, sustainable that is. Where do you see the industry going there? How can we make sure that what everybody enjoys in terms of wearing and having these objects also is sort of in sync with creating a more responsible future for our planet?
Yeah, I mean, as you're pointing out, right, it's of course a difficult relationship in a sense, right? Because, I mean, you know, of course we write about all the great and cool new things that come out on a consistent basis. And yet at the same time, we're in touch with an audience that cares deeply and more so every single day about sustainability and about the health of the planet and the impact that, you know, their behavior has on the planet. And so, you know, it's really also making in a big way, you know, it's entering our space since quite a few years. You know, this week we launched the Highest and Mighty Better Earth Manual, you know, as a kind of guide for style and enthusiasts, you know, in the current ecological crisis, and, you know, to kind of just give background on what is happening, what can we do, you know, and then also practical questions, you know, how sustainable is really the sneaker that you're wearing? How can you support garment workers around the world? What actually happens to donated clothing? What are the best, you know, resale fashion sites that that you should be taking a look at? What about all this terminology that you hear every day, you know, from organic cotton, cruelty-free, resale? Like, what does this all mean? You know, so we took a very practical approach there and kind of wanted to be a resource for our audience. And and I think, you know, every day that goes by, this topic becomes, you know, more important. And, you know, it's a difficult one, of course, because it's not something that anybody, that any brand, any retailer can just change overnight. You know, it's a process that everybody has to, you know, be a part of, where everybody needs to support change, and a change in behavior, of course, on the consumer side triggers change on the brand side. I think the exciting part is that we've arrived at a point, I think, where everybody has realized that I think we're probably still in kind of this in-between generation, but the next one will just not accept it anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, as a brand, you have absolutely no chance with that generation unless you have a very clear sustainability strategy, you know, a clear strategy, you know, to fix your footprint on our planet. Mm. And that will enforce change, you know, I think in a very rigorous way over the next years. And I think, you know, as always, it needs to get to a point where it's the new normal, you know, where it, you know, it's nothing special anymore. It's not something that you can market. It's just a given in a sense. Yeah. And,
yeah.
I think that's what we have to all work towards. And, you know, we still have a long way to go on one hand, but talking about it, you know, thinking about it as part of everything that you do feels increasingly normal, I would say.
No, and I think it's really important that, you know, platforms like yours create awareness, because ultimately, I think awareness amongst the clientele raises the right question, and ultimately then also puts the impetus and really onto the entire industry to make those changes. And as you say, it's a step-by-step journey. I think we in the watch business are somewhat lucky that we've made products for eternity for a long time, purely mechanical, powered by the energy of your wrists and designed to last forever, and generally have been working on being low impact for quite some time. But it is a journey. And ultimately the same when I talk about today recycled and vegan straps, or I talk about fully recycled rubber straps. It is only when the general demand and the conversation gets to a critical point that the entire industry then magically finds the innovation key and actually, you know, changes things for the better.
Absolutely, yeah.
On that note, that's a much better vision for the future. Let's hope it'll be a successful one as well. Thank you so much, David. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I'm wishing you and the entire Heisner Biotech team all the best, and I'm looking forward to our upcoming collaborations as well. I can't wait to reveal more about that. Thanks for being with us today. All the best over to your end, and stay safe, stay healthy. Send our best to the team and speak to you all very soon.
Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, everybody in the audience, for listening, and talk to you soon for the next episode of Partners in Time. Stay tuned. Cheers. All the best. Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. This is the Partners in Time podcast. Make sure you subscribe to never miss an episode. If you want to find out more, visit IWC.com. And you can, of course, follow us on Instagram. It's at IWC Watches. My Instagram is at Chris Granger Hare. Make sure you tune in. Speak to you soon.